Welcome to the Phil Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 12:09 p.m. Today is Pacific Summer Time today. And of course, being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And there really is a lot to talk about this week because there have been so many events that have occurred. But I thought I would kick off with some very long-term charts to try and put everything into perspective, because I think there's a lot of people are looking at the market right now and they have a lot of questions. There has obviously been a great deal of volatility, and that tends to upset sentiment, and we need to start to think about what does this all mean in terms of the bigger picture. And if I can come anywhere close to trying to address that particular question in this broadcast, well, I'll consider it a success. Well, when we look at, for example, the Dow Gold Ratio, we have 100 years of history, we have 35 years between the peaks, and we've had a substantial rally since the low in 2011. Even here, we're starting to see now some evidence that gold is starting to outperform stock markets. Now, what does that tell us? Well, the chances are, if we're going to be truly long-term in perspective, that the most likely scenario is that this peak, or this trend higher since 2011, will eventually peak somewhere in the mid-2035s, that the level of the ratio will be somewhere higher than 40, and potentially significantly higher than 40, and that will represent the peak of a secular bull market in equities. So that suggests that since we're now in 2018, that there's potentially another 15 or even 17 years of a bull market ahead of us. So why is it that everyone is so worried right now? Well, of course, it's because the stock market has been advancing for a decade, that it's one of the longest economic expansions in history. There are increasing signs that there are excesses, particularly in the bond markets, that will eventually need to be dealt with. And we've also had some companies that have done spectacularly well, and quite a few of those don't have any earnings, or certainly don't have profits. So these are things that people are worried about. That's before we even begin to talk about the fact that you have a brewing trade war, that what I've described as the play-along to get-along way of dealing with international relationships is pretty much over, and that this is having geopolitical repercussions. Geopolitics isn't something that we ever used to have to talk about, and now it's practically impossible to avoid. Well, that tells us just how much of a change has occurred. Well, then we have to start to think about that it's an additional risk premium that's on the market, and that it does have the potential to represent an issue at some point in the future. What we have continued to see over the last year and more is that geopolitical issues have arisen and disappeared with regularity without having a very much of an impact on the performance of stock markets. Well, we've seen that change somewhat over the course of the last few weeks. Now, some of the reason for the big pullback that we've seen is because we've had rather wide overextensions relative to the trend mean on a significant number of technology shares. And we've started to see that those being unwound, often in a dynamic manner, since the release of this Bloomberg news story accusing the Chinese government of hacking the hardware supply chain for the semiconductor industry. Well, the companies involved, like Apple and Amazon, have vociferously denied that allegation, but Bloomberg is sticking to its guns and is continuing to quote government sources. And of course, that's the most important point. It's government sources within the U.S. administration that have fueled this particular, affront to the international order. So that has resulted in some souring of sentiment, particularly towards the semiconductors sector, but most particularly towards the kinds of companies that have really relied on Chinese manufacturing. Well, when we think about the outlook for where we are in the global markets, I will certainly come to some of the individual shares in a moment, but I'd like to stick with these longer term charts first. The yield curve spread tends to move in this very wide pattern, that there are occasions when it goes negative, and they have almost universally been associated as lead indicators for future recessions. And the trend has certainly been downwards since the peaks at over 250 basis points back in 2009 and 2010. Well, we're starting to see now that the 10-year is rising somewhat faster than the 2-year, and that is leading to this spread starting to advance again. Well, as long as it's advancing, then the likelihood of an inversion is reduced. And when we think about the lead indicator that represents, well, it can be anything from 6 to 18 months. So that's, I think, an important consideration. And considering that we do not have an inverted yield curve, and yes, it is only at 28 basis points, so we've had certainly a lot of flattening of the curve, but it is not inverted, and that suggests that we are not going to have a recession at any point in the next 6 or 2 18 months. But it has become almost a parlor game among investors to predict when the next recession is going to be. Well, we definitely know that we're in the latter stages of this really impressive advance since the lows in 2008 and 2009, because it's already an historically lengthy expansion. But it's being fueled by the USA's adoption of quantitative easing, and then the almost seamless adoption of fiscal stimulus. Well, that has contributed to economic growth really surging on the upside. Now, what I find particularly interesting right now is that we are not seeing any real discussion about productivity. That one of the most, I think, widely held opinions among the intelligentsia has been that productivity growth peaked in the early 1990s, and it has been trending lower since. But that is simply not the case. And in fact, if we look at the charts, well, we've seen that really since the presidential election, that productivity has been trending higher. And this is, I think, a rather important characteristic here, that if productivity growth is starting to trend higher, well, then that is where we can start to see some of the demands for higher wages being rationalized, that a lot of the debt issues that people are very worried about become less pressing if you get productivity growth. And so this is a rather important characteristic. Then you also have an additional characteristic, that you have the tax cuts that have just gone through. And it is certainly true that a lot of the money that has been brought home from overseas because of the tax holiday on foreign earnings has been plowed back into share buybacks. But there is also the rather important point that the age of fixed infrastructure and fixed assets of businesses in the USA is at almost 23 years on average. And that does suggest that there is ample potential for an infrastructure build, which is also a rather useful purpose to put fiscal stimulus. So when we think about where we are in terms of the global economy and the US economy, well, the US is definitely benefiting from the reduction in taxes and the fiscal stimulus. Now, the big question is, how long is it going to take the rest of the global economy to get the message? Because the US economy was the first into recession in the credit crisis, and it was one of the most aggressive in getting the banks to write off their debts. Well, you didn't have that same write-off of debts in Europe, and the banks are still saddled with all that debt. And then in China, they engaged in a massive stimulus. And what that simply did was to exacerbate the debt leverage that was existing in the economy. And you have S&P and Moody's this week saying that there is upwards of $4 to $5 trillion in off-balance sheet debt that has been accumulated by the regional administrations in China, which makes a nonsense of their debt to GDP ratios. The debt to GDP ratio before this was confirmed was in the order of 260%. It could be quite a bit higher than that. It could be well in excess of 300%, and that takes it into the realm of being even more indebted than Japan. Well, it's only as long as debt ratios continue to expand that you can continue to see asset prices inflating. Well, what this really suggests is that China is where we have the real potential for an epicenter of risk. And what will be most, I think, acutely realized by a lot of people in China or in the Chinese administration is that the only way they're going to hold things together is if they can remove the risk of capital flight. So there's increasing evidence that people's passports are being taken away, that the police state is becoming increasingly more overbearing, that these rep from the perspective of a foreign investor, these represent clear deteriorations in terms of governance. But from the Chinese perspective, they are absolutely essential if they're going to contain the risk from capital flight. Then I will certainly go ahead and look at some of the Chinese markets because we've definitely had some big movements in here this week. But the additional point that we have that is on the in the background of the global economy is that we have seen over the course of the last 40 years one of the biggest bull markets in bonds ever. And I continue to think that the best way to monitor that is with the total return on 10-year Treasury futures. It's the most consistent, well, that's not no longer true. It was the most consistent chart in the world. From its imposition in 1983, it only went up until approximately 2016, and now it is no longer rising. So we have evolving top formation characteristics. At the very minimum, there is a loss of momentum, but we have a progression of lower rally highs, evident over the last 3 years, and that's not something that we've seen before. This really suggests that the bull market in bonds is over. Now, just if we go back and think about what I was saying with regard to China, that it you can continue to benefit from increasing debt ratios as long as you can refinance and issue more debt to fund more growth. But it's when yields start to rise and availability of credit starts to deteriorate that you run into trouble. And now the big question is, what's going to happen to the social democratic way of thinking and the administrations that have been built up, particularly in Europe, on the back of debt, in an environment where the global trading regime is starting to deteriorate? The simple fact of the matter is that administrations in Europe and in the USA made a big bet with the livelihoods of their domestic populations that by affording China the opportunity to enter the global trading community on very accommodative terms, that would stoke the potential for reform and liberalization, and that they could turn China from being a competitor into being an honest and or I think globally interested broker in the international trading regime. And the simple fact of the matter is that they were wrong. They made a big bet and it failed. So now what we're starting to see is the walk back of that allowance that China had been afforded by entrance to the WTO back in 2000. What it literally represented was the export of millions of jobs from Europe and North America to China, and the ability for China to become the workshop of the world. So now that is starting to change. Part of the reason why this whole hacking scandal was revealed, even though it is alleged to have occurred almost 3 years ago, is to really ram home the point that the situation has changed. What I find particularly interesting is that the media simply does not seem to get the point that this is a changed environment, that this is not an isolated incident, that the entire order of the world is changing. That is also representative of the top formation that we're getting in bonds. These are not coincidences. These are symptomatic of a wider change in the market. What that suggests is that the centrism and the difference between different that the polarity that we're seeing in the political process right across the world is going to persist and probably going to get worse. The Russians have pretty much concluded that there are no more rules, that the Trump administration started off by vilifying the press corps, and now we're seeing that Saudi Arabia has essentially murdered one of the most prominent members of the press corps. Well, again, this is a further iteration of the fact that there are no rules any longer. That the way that people tend to think about what is normal and acceptable in terms of the global way of play along to get along is over. That's likely to correspond with higher yields. And it would be appropriate that with better productivity numbers that you would have a higher yield as well. So there are a number of factors that are pushing us on towards higher yielding environment on the bond markets. Well, if bonds are more likely than not to trend lower for the foreseeable future, at least until we see the next recession, which would obviously then create a short covering rally and a bounce, well, then the likelihood is that money is going to have to flow out of it and into something. Well, stocks are a potential destination for that cash. But then we have to start to think about that we have an evolving environment, and what is it that is going to benefit and what is not going to benefit? That is perhaps the biggest, I think, prognostication that we can start to come to conclusions about. Well, right now what we're seeing is that the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index has got type 2 top formation characteristics. And one of the things that people say is that a bull market will rise on good and bad news, but the opposite is also true. And ASML, for example, had a very good day on, I think it was Tuesday or Wednesday, and then gave up the entire advance. And now we're seeing the index testing the lower side of its range, but it is now trading below the trend mean. Now, if this is in, let's just compare the action that we're seeing right now with what we saw, for example, on the S&P 500, but back in 2008. I remember when I first went to the chart seminar with David, all the way back in all the way back in the early 2000s, there was I found it rather difficult to identify type 2 tops. Well, if we look at how did the move on the S&P 500 start to unwind back in 2008, well, we had a loss of momentum. The market had been trending higher in a very persistent manner for a prolonged period. Then we had an uptick in the pace of the advance between 2006 and the middle of 2007. We had a failed upside break at the end of 2007. It dropped back down to the lower side of the range and then it broke down. But then it went sideways, so we got a first step below the peak, and people were starting to think at that point, well, it couldn't possibly get any worse. This is about as bad as it's likely to get. And then we started to see the bankruptcies, first of Bear Stearns and then Lehman Brothers. Well, I don't anticipate that the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index is going to have the same impact on the global economy that the peak that we saw in 2000 for the S&P is going to have, or did have. But the pattern is eerily similar. So when we look at this particular pattern, it needs to rally and rally rather smartly in order to really demonstrate that we are back in a demand-dominated environment. I was talking with investors during the week, and they were saying, "Oh, well, the semiconductors have already had a big pullback." But if this is a top formation, the pullback hasn't even started. So this is an important time to bear particular attention to these kinds of companies. Then, when we look at the outlook for the cloud sector, well, we can look at a cloud ETF, and the first cloud, our first trust cloud ETF is a good example. Then this index has pulled back to the region of the trend mean. The trend mean now corresponds with the peak that we saw back in January, or in fact, it was in March. So now is the point where if it's going to find support, then this is about the area that it could still be considered a consistent trend if it bounces from this level. But if it starts to pull back below $50, well, then we're going to be talking about a major trend inconsistency. So that's a significant issue that we need to bear in mind. So this is also one of the best performing sectors that we've seen over the course of the last few years. And if the cloud computing sector starts to roll over, well, then that it represents a rather big challenge from the perspective of the momentum-driven bull market. So then when we look at the Nasdaq has got a very similar pattern to the cloud ETF. It has pulled back to the region of the upper side of its underlying range, and it is steadying. So we are starting to see some evidence that demand is coming back in, but the rally that we've seen so far this week has just about held. That 7,000 area represents a big level of potential support, and it really does need to hold if the fears that are growing among investors that we're starting to see some unwinding of this big move we've seen in the semiconductors and the cloud computing shares is going to be unwound. Well, then if we look at some of the more highly indebted companies, well, Netflix was also very notable in here this week by posting some very impressive growth numbers, but then it was not able to hold its advance. And investors are starting to think that that may be about as good as things are going to get. So then the question now is whether the move that we've seen in Netflix is the most important question is whether it is going to hold this $300 area. We've had the massive reaction against the prevailing trend that unwound the overbought condition relative to the trend mean. But now the question is whether it is going to bounce from this area. Well, I've been saying, I think you're probably sick of hearing me say that I just don't watch Netflix anymore. Well, something else that I thought I would share with you is my daughter had to get braces about 8 or 9 months ago, and we inquired about the Invisalign braces for her teeth, and our dentist refused to install them, saying that they were useless, that they were nothing more than cosmetic, and that they would not work in realigning her teeth. And I thought that was that really came back to my mind when I saw this massive reaction against the prevailing trend for Align Technology. And It is now coming back below the trend mean. It would need to bounce and do so in an emphatic manner to really demonstrate that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. Well, what we can definitely see here is that there is increasing selling pressure starting to come through in the technology sector. But it's not all of the technology sector, but primarily it's the cloud and the semiconductor part of the technology sector. When we look at the biotechnology sector, well, we don't have the same degree of overextensions relative to the trend mean, and the index is now right in the region of its trend mean, and the pace of the advance has been much more moderate. It doesn't have the same overextension or overweighting in terms of ETF positions that some of those other higher flying sectors have. When we look at, for example, Nvidia, that was the best performing share in 2016, and again in 2017, it's lost momentum this year. It's broken its progression of higher reaction lows. This is again an evolving massive reaction against the prevailing trend. And the big question is going to be whether it's going to bounce, and if it does so, is it going to be able to push back above $250? So these are significant developments within the really high flying part of the market. AMD having doubled. In the middle part of this year is now rapidly unwinding at this overextension relative to the trend mean. So what is doing better? What is it that we could found the basis that we're getting a rotation rather than a major top starting to develop in here? Well, what people are starting to look at, particularly when you put into context the fact that we have an environment where people are worried about the supply chain for the technology sector. Well, they're betting on companies that aren't affected by that. Well, Disney is one of those, and it's been ranging for almost 4 years, and now it is breaking on the upside. Well, it's on the cusp of breaking on the upside. I think when you look at, for example, the fact that Verizon has been ranging for the better part of 5 years, and people are not going to be, they're not going to cancel their mobile phone subscription because of issues with the supply chain in China. Then, when we look at, for example, the earnings that came through today for Procter and Gamble, well, analysts are hazy on whether there is going to be follow through on the upside, but this is another share that's been ranging for 5 years. Now, this does not gel with the fact that a number of these types of companies, whether it is Procter and Gamble or McDonald's or Coca-Cola, that they're often bought for their bond-like characteristics. But what they're being bought for right now is for their relative sense of security. These consumer-oriented, dividend aristocrat autonomies are starting to attract investor interest. And for example, Walmart has been up in a rather dynamic manner this week. It's bouncing from the region of the trend mean, and this is a rather important move. Then you look at, for example, Johnson and Johnson. It's bouncing from the region of its trend mean. In fact, if we look at the healthcare sector, well, Merck and Pfizer have both broken up out of very clear patterns of consolidation. Well, what this suggests to me is that there is not just a small rotation going on, but rather large rotation, and that the technology sector that has made all the running over the course of the last 2 years is due for some pause and consolidation. And in fact, it's been led lower by Facebook. Facebook had that massive reaction, a huge downside weekly key reversal in the middle of the year. And I continue to think that the most likely scenario is that it is going to range potentially for a prolonged period. That if we just simply look at the length of the consolidations that we've seen in some of the more consumer-oriented sectors, then we could be looking at ranges that for anything from a couple of years to 5 years for something like Facebook or something like Google. Google's trend has lost consistency. It is now trading below the trend mean. That was after a much larger pullback than we've seen in the context of the 10-year advance. And $1,000 is an awfully big psychological level for the price on Google. So these are, I think, rather important developments that we're seeing a significant change that's going on right now, that the very clear leaders within this market are starting to roll over. Whereas Apple has, and being the largest company in the world, has been a stalwart, because not only does it, well, it is benefiting from the fact that there has been silence in terms of the supply chain for its products, but also that it has a very clear foothold both in China and in the USA. And the share has been conspicuously firmer. This does not mean that it's not immune, that there is still an overextension here, and that overextension is approximately $25. So an additional 10%, and this would still be, on the downside, would still be a reasonably consistent advance. And it was in positive territory in here today. What we are starting to see, though, is increasing evidence that the trade war and the measures that are underway are taking a toll. And eBay's earnings were today, and it was down 10%, and it is one of the biggest casualties of the decision to remove the USA from the postal treaty. When we look at, for example, stamps.com, well, they don't do practically any business in Asia, and yet the share has been pulling back in a rather dynamic manner. Well, what that suggests at the moment is that we are definitely in a more emotional market, that there is very clear evidence of some contagion starting to come through, and that this is resulting in the baby getting thrown out with the bathwater, that there are going to be some rather impressive buying opportunities that arise as people start to really to come to terms with where the risks are and where the opportunities are. Well, I think these are important developments. When, for example, we look at the utilities sector, that utilities have bounced pretty impressively. Now, the big question that people have been asking is, when you look at the 10-year Treasury yield, and it is currently at approximately 3.2% and trending higher, then how on earth is it that these dividend growth type companies have been keeping pace? Shouldn't they be under pressure? And that was certainly the case earlier this year, where we had the consumer staples sector pulling back in a very violent manner. And this was a major trend in consistency when it pulled back and broke its sequence of higher reaction lows. But I think now that with this very clear move on the upside that we're seeing in here this week, that a change is underway, that something has definitely changed in terms of the way that investors are viewing this market. And I don't wonder whether people are starting to take a leaf out of the policies that the Bank of Switzerland and the Bank of Japan have been pursuing. They have been buying stocks rather than accumulating bonds. Well, they've been accumulating bonds too, but they have both been very active in accumulating positions in strong cash flow companies with strong records of increasing their dividends. In a rising interest rate environment, it is strong cash flows which can grow, and with cash flows that can grow at a rate in excess of the rate of interest or inflation, are how you protect yourself. And that is what these globally oriented consumer brands offer. So if one were to really try to hedge against the potential for technology to roll over, Well, it is in these consumer sectors. And I think that this is something that is really just starting to become apparent in here this week, with the significant potential that we're going to start to see these ranges that have persisted for 5 years already starting to be resolved on the upside. Well, then if we think about where are we in terms of this cycle? Well, the markets are endlessly fractal. So, in the short term, there's definitely a rotation going on, and that is likely to correspond with additional volatility on the major indices. So, we could potentially have a good deal of back and forth trading on Wall Street. Well, then, if we do get a rotation and that the consumer sectors start to pick up, well, that will start to have an impact on the S&P. It's what I find particularly interesting is that the Dividend Aristocrats ETF is also right in the region of its trend mean. And the part of the reason for that is because it is loaded with companies that are not only consumer oriented, but are also industrially oriented. And it is the industrial companies that are starting to take some pressure. When, for example, we look at Lenexis in Germany, well, this looks like a completing top formation. So we look at what's going on in Europe right now, and against the background of all the other factors that we have discussed so far. If we look at, for example, the MDAX, which has been the clear best performer, best performing index in Germany over the course of this decade, then it has pulled back below the 25,000 level. It has broken its sequence of higher reaction lows, and this isn't the first time it's done that. But the big question is, what's going to happen with European equities if they persist on the ECB's route of unwinding quantitative easing and stop buying bonds, with trade wars brewing between the USA and China? Where does that leave Europe? Well, what we started to see in here today was that Europe is not entirely self-destructive. And what we're starting to see in Italy is that the pace of the advance is accelerating. But what we're also starting to see when we look at Europe is that the Europeans know that they should sanction the Italian administration for breaking the fiscal rules and from I think diverting from the Maastricht Treaty. But they also realize that Italy is a major economy, that it has a substantial debt problem already, and that by sanctioning the country, that it is going to bring to a head the potential that eventually that some big country like Italy is going to leave the EU. Well, that's something that they're going to want to avoid at all costs, and it's looking increasingly likely that the Europeans are going to look the other way when Italy decides that it is going to break its fiscal rules, and that is going to offer a green light to an increasingly large number of countries to do the same. The only way that we can really start to come up with a bullish argument for why the euro stocks should be doing better is if we get fiscal stimulus. And I think that that is starting to become a better potential outcome. Now, the question is how they're going to square that with Germany, because Germany is already has signs that there are the property market is overheating, and it already has a dearth of labor. So, and beginning to see rising inflationary pressures. But the rest of Europe needs a fiscal stimulus. That 10 years of living with the impact of the credit crisis, where private sector debts were pushed onto sovereigns and people were expected to pay for it, has weighed on sentiment and is starting to affect the electoral process. So I think in the one thing we can rely on politicians to be is self-interested, and that they will eventually come to their senses that the only way to blunt the rise of populism is to give them more money. And the way to give people more money is either with tax cuts or fiscal stimulus. So if we get fiscal stimulus in Europe, then that will be a bullish catalyst for additional upside. Now, when we start to look at what's going on in China, China has massive debts and it also has massive savings, and it has an admirable export-oriented market. Well, what we're starting to see finally is that the administration is starting to take interest in the stock market. We saw an upside key reversal in here this week. Excuse me, in here today. Follow through on the upside on Monday would confirm a low of at least near-term significance, and that would greatly increase the potential that we're going to see a reversion back up towards that sequence of lower rally highs that's been in evidence for all of this year so far. Big advances on the Chinese market have almost universally been state-sponsored. So we're going to have to see that there is a clear state sponsorship to the potential for a rally to take hold. If we don't get state sponsorship, well, then this medium-term decline is going to persist. The problem for China is that it likes to think of itself as a champion of free trade, but that isn't the case. That they have been one of the chief beneficiaries of free trade without, in fact, engaging in free trade, because they have protected their domestic market from competition while availing of every possible benefit from the commitment of other countries to engage in free trade. And that situation is now over. The attitude that you have within the US administration is, I think, likely to persist beyond the current administration, because the rise of populism and the change that that has, or the threat that that represents to constitutional democracy, is non-trivial and is more important than just about anything else. Well, I think that China is the epicenter of risk, that it does represent significant challenges, that there is a complete dearth of governance, and that the only reason that one would have positions there is because one believes that there is going to be some state sponsorship for asset price appreciation. We've already seen over the last couple of weeks that there have been significant discounts announced on property developments in China, and that has led to street protests. The Shanghai Property Index is right back on that 5,000 level, and we're starting to see just the first evidence coming in here today that demand is starting to return. It was an upside key reversal in here today, but not a particularly large one. And the key to the key is size. So a dynamic follow-through on the upside would really be required to confirm the signal in here. We do have short-term oversold conditions in China, so there is the potential that we could have a bounce, but then the question is whether the sequence of lower rally highs will be broken. And we can argue indefinitely about the ability of the Chinese administration to really tackle the debt problems that are extent or that are in the domestic market. It would be impossible for China to deal with those problems if they have to contend with capital flight. So when we look at the renminbi, they want a weaker currency. They need to make the economy more competitive, particularly in a tariff-heavy environment. The way to obviate that headwind is to have a weaker currency. But if they have a weaker currency, they'll encourage capital flight. So they have to crack down on any and all means to contain capital flight. And that means that the police state is going to become progressively more overbearing. The one big takeaway that my family had from visiting China this summer was the growing sense of unease among people in what is essentially a very happy-go-lucky, free-wheeling area that around Guangzhou. And that was a complete change from the kind of environment that we've experienced over the course of the last decade. That's a significant change. It really does tell us that China is under pressure, and that that pressure is likely to continue, not least because the Trump administration is taking on the fact that China announced last year that they now view the USA as a strategic competitor. Well, they're also building a blue water navy. They are expanding their ties internationally. They're using debt as chains of bondage for a number of emerging markets. So this is not no longer simply a domestic environment, but rather something that is occurring on a much more global basis, that really trying to get China to obey the global order in terms of trade is almost too much to ask for. Well, therefore, the only way that we're going to see the market start to rally is if the Chinese sovereign wealth funds start to engage and start buying in an aggressive manner. What we've also started to see is that the leadership of the major tech companies have been attacked. That Ponyma's Tencent Holdings, well, they banned computer games. So there won't be any new computer games coming into China. So that has resulted in Tencent, which is the biggest constituent of the emerging markets index, trending lower in a dynamic manner. It just so happens that Alibaba CEO Jack Ma is retiring. So that is taking him out of the equation. Then you had the CEO of JD.com just happened to be found in a rape case in Minnesota. And that's also rather suspicious. Then you have the fact that Wang Jian just simply fell off of a cliff in China, or excuse me, in the south of France back in August. So it's rather dangerous to be a CEO in China these days. And what that also represents is the increasingly long reach of the communist administration into the management of these companies, that the profit motivation has been subsumed towards the interests of the sovereign. And that's not good news for stock market investors. So China is, I think, a massive source of potential volatility, and it needs to be monitored particularly closely. I think that eventually we are going to see an increasingly large number of countries moving towards fiscal stimulus, and that is something that is likely to result in significant fuel for stock market advances and also for higher yields in a current environment. And I think that is what we're starting to see right now in the USA. Well, there is no country needs better productivity and more inflation than Japan. And the Nikkei right now is right in the region of the trend mean. The most important thing that it has done in the last 30 years is to sustain that move above 20,000. And I continue to think that as long as it is trading above that level, well, then we're in a new secular bull market for Japan. The fact that the second section index has continued to hold that 7,000 area, and despite the fact that the Nikkei was down, the second section was up in here this week. That gives me some confidence that the lows are in, or that we are close to an important low for the Japanese market. Now, Japan is surprising a lot of investors because they have adopted a really quite considerable immigration policy that was really not on the cards at all before Abe's administration. Then they are also weakening their currency. What we're also starting to see is that the JGB yield is, I think I've not typed that correctly, GJGB. Well, JGB yields are starting to push higher, and this is the market with the lowest yields in the world. Then you also have the fact that the 10-year yield in Germany is still only at 46 basis points. Well, it's hard to conclude that we have globally restrictive credit conditions when you have such a wide difference between the yields on the 10-year in Germany and the 10-year in the USA. And this represents a significant issue, especially when you have a strong dollar. Because if you've got a strong dollar, then what that does is it picks up the carry on the difference between the Bund and the Treasury. And this represents a significant carry trade. It's one of the reasons behind why Wall Street has been so firm. It's also one of the reasons why the yield on bonds hasn't been surging higher, because you've got foreign investors that have been continuing to buy US Treasuries. The fact that you have such a huge amount of additional supply is going to contribute over the medium term. Eventually, the yield on US and European bonds is going to come back into some form of equilibrium. Well, then that will represent a significant change. That will be a major reallocation. Europe has been continuing to underperform, and for good reason. And they're going to need to do something dynamic and to really start to get the engine running again in terms of domestic growth and really starting to get their markets moving again. So there is certainly potential out there that we're going to see more bullish action starting to take hold. But right now, the most important thing that's going on is this rotation, and that you're getting certainly selling pressure starting to come through in some of the shares that have been most high flying. That then also you have the fact that just because the high yield sector in the USA has not been expanding, although it was up this week, that does not mean that high yield bond spreads have not been rising in Europe and in China, and that there is risk in companies like Netflix and in Tesla. Tesla, or Elon Musk, announced again over Twitter during the week that they're bringing to market a lower priced Model 3. But of course, they don't make any money on their cars. The most important thing that Tesla has done is demonstrate that it is possible to create an electric vehicle that people aspire to own. Now the question is whether it will ever make money. That is also the question that a lot of the conventional automotive producers are starting to ask as well. Daimler was down in a dynamic manner in early trading in here today, but it is oversold relative to the trend mean. It could still rally $10 and be in a still a rather consistent downtrend. But I do think that we're due some pause and consolidation coming through in here. I think if we are still in a secular bull market, it's logical that we're going to start to see some people starting to hedge their bets. And the rise of or the potential for consumer-oriented cash flow secure companies doing well here is an indication that people are starting to move more towards defensives. And that's generally representative of the latter stages of a bull market. So we have to conclude that whereas there is no real evidence that we can anticipate that there's going to be a recession at any time in the next 12 months, investors are beginning to position themselves for that eventuality. So I think that's one of the more important conclusions that we can draw. And one of the ways that people also position themselves for that kind of eventuality is by buying gold. And gold prices were completely inert this week, but the most important thing they've done of late is to break the sequence of lower rally highs. Well, the dollar was also quite firm in here this week. If we look at the price in euro, well, it has also clearly broken its downtrend. If we look at it in pounds, then it's breaking its downtrend. In Australian dollars, it's been trending higher for a while already. But I think the more important point here is that when we look at it in renminbi, and maybe look at it with some perspective over the course of the last 7 or 8 years, well, we can see that this is a significant rally. When we start to look at it in Indian rupee, well, prices are back where they were in 2016 and coming towards the upper side of the range from back in 2012 and 13. The Brazilian real has been among the weakest currency in the world until quite recently, and now that's changing. One thing I find particularly interesting is that gold prices here are pretty close to where they were back in 2016, and that is significantly above where they were in 2012 and 2011. That'll tell us just how much the Brazilian real has declined. The problem with focusing unduly on China is that really quite big events that are occurring in other markets tend to get ignored. And we have the potential for the state of deteriorating governance in Brazil to at least be arrested in here, with the potential for Bolsonaro to be elected. Now, a populist administration is probably not going to gel particularly well with the media, but if it does anything to combat the corruption within the administrative system in Brazil, then it will be a net positive. And the real now has closed its overextension relative to the trend mean. This is a significant development. Everyone back in September was worried about Turkey, but the Turkish lira is unwinding its oversold condition relative to the trend mean, and that was a very clear acceleration to the 7 point. Well, it doesn't mean that the lira is going to strengthen through 5, but it suggests that that 7 area is probably going to hold for a while longer. The potential here is that the Argentine peso has also found a low of more than short-term significance. Again, this has been a lengthy period where the peso has been trending lower, and that's not, well, I think that's unlikely to change, but there have been periods when the peso has been more stable, and we're probably in one right now. And that brings us to think about the Indian rupee, because the rupee has been steadying up over the last few days, but the problem when we look at it on that very long-term basis, it did look for a while that the rupee was capable of holding more than a short-term low. And this decline that we've seen over the last 8 months has really helped to put that hope to rest. So India has got a significant current account deficit, and it has a large domestic economy. It's very heavily leveraged to or negatively impacted, perhaps would be a better way to think about it, by the oil price. And then you have the fact that the RBI is weighing on the banking sector. So the banks have been under quite a lot of duress over the course of the last 6 or 7 weeks, and they encountered resistance this week in the region of the trend mean. Now, this is a rather important point here, that if it can really sustain a move back above the trend mean, well, we can put this down to a corrective phase. If it fails here and breaks downwards, well, then we have to start talking about a type 2 top. So this is a rather important point for the banking sector. But the most pressure is coming to bear on the privately held banks. And Yes Bank, having pulled back extraordinarily violently, has bounced, but now the big question is whether it's going to be able to hold its low. India is moving, and certainly against the private sector, in an aggressive manner to tackle the bad loans that have cropped up within it. China is not doing that. China has not yet forced its regional banks and its regional administrations to bring their off-balance sheet liabilities into the open. Well, India is a democracy. India has an independent judiciary and it has a free press. It doesn't mean that you don't have corruption. Corruption is endemic. But the pattern of governance is improving. And then you also have the fact that we are in a situation with India that they are at the cusp of their digital dividend, whereas China has pretty much already enjoyed that digital dividend. So that's an important characteristic here, that eventually the Chinese market is going to have to deal with the excesses that are outstanding within it. India is doing that now. That's contributing to this underperformance. When we look at, for example, the JP Morgan India Trust, then it has pulled back in a violent manner, and that pullback does not yet look like it is quite over. Eventually, that is going to represent a very clear buying opportunity. And India represents our favorite market for the long term, but the chances are that I think we're going to get a better buying opportunity at some point in the future. Now, when I start to pull all of this together, well, I think that we're definitely in a rotation. The market is starting to price that in. The pricing in of this rotation is going to take time. If it takes too much time, well, then we're going to have an evolving loss of momentum and a top formation. If it takes less time, well, then we're going to get another leg on the upside. With productivity improving, with the economy still doing well, with still low unemployment, then the question is whether the Federal Reserve is going to continue to raise interest rates next year. If they pause, well, then I think the case for a clear acceleration on the upside, which would be climactic for this almost decade-long advance, would certainly increase. In the meantime, I think that the pressure that's coming to bear in the emerging markets and on China in particular, well, that is creating opportunities because markets like Brazil and Thailand have been experiencing selling pressure, but they don't have the same exposure to the issues that are outstanding in China that other markets do. So I do think that we are seeing a clear rotation out of the things that worked really well over the course of the last decade and perhaps into things that are more defensive in nature. We're still in a secular bull market. That really brings us back to the fractal nature of markets. But there is no secular bull market is not eventually punctuated by occasional bouts of volatility and corrections. And this is a corrective phase right now. But the vast majority of indices, or at least on Wall Street, are trading above their respective trend means. And as long as that remains the case, well, then I think we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. At the same time, I think the gold price is really quite cheap at these levels, and there is certainly the potential here that it is in defensive type sectors where we're going to see the best potential for outperformance going forward. I'm going to be traveling next week. I'll be in Dubai and Singapore. It's a, sort of a whistle stop round the world tour, and that means that I don't anticipate any interruption to service, but I will be posting comment of the day based on my my jet lag and my sleep schedule, and rather than the exact timing of the close on Wall Street. So I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.